Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. This week on the podcast, we're featuring a series of shows that highlight just a few of the great innovations and innovators at the intersection of three very important and familiar topics: data science, the Python programming language, and open source software. To better understand our listeners' views on the importance of open source and the projects and players in this space, I'm conducting a survey, which I'd be very grateful if you took a moment to complete. To access the survey, visit twimmelai.com/pythonsurvey. Please hit pause now and we'll wait for you to get back. That's twimmelai.com/pythonsurvey. Before we dive into the show, I'd like to send a huge thanks to our sponsor for this series, IBM. Speaking of open source, IBM has a long history of engaging in and supporting open source projects that are important to enterprise data science. Projects like Hadoop, Spark, Jupyter, and Kubeflow, to name just a few. IBM also hosts the IBM Data Science Community, which is a place for enterprise data scientists looking to learn, share, and engage with their peers and industry-renowned practitioners. There you'll find informative tutorials and case studies, Q&As with leaders in the field, and a lively forum covering a variety of topics of interest to both beginning and experienced data scientists. Check out and join the IBM Data Science community by visiting ibm.com/community/data science. All right, everyone, I am on the line with Inez Montani. Inez is the co-founder of Explosion, a co-developer of the popular NLP open source library Spacey, and lead developer of Prodigy. Inez, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Yay, thanks. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm excited to have you on as well. I've been looking forward to speaking with you for quite some time now. I'd love to hear a little bit about how you got started on this path of working at this confluence of open source and AI and Python. How did it all happen?
Yeah, so I actually had to try out quite a few things to kind of end up at this point where I found kind of like the perfect job that combines all of the things I like doing and all of kind of my skills and things I'm good at. So I initially, like I've always been into programming. So I grew up on the internet. Like I've made websites when we got our first computer when I was like 11. So I was really into that. So I spent most of my teenage years building websites basically. And, but I didn't actually choose to go into computer science. So I did, my degree in communication science and linguistics, which are also things I was really interested in. I worked in media for a while, but like I was always kind of programming on the side and doing those kinds of things. So, I met my co-founder and also the, initial Spacey author, Matthew Honnable, in 2014 here in Berlin. And yeah, we just started working together and we quickly realized that we had very similar ideas about like, you know, building software, making the technology accessible, making it usable. So we decided to found a company together, Explosion. Initially, we bootstrapped with a bit of consulting and then focused 100% on product development for developer tools. And yeah, Prodigy was our first product that we launched.
Awesome. And so Spacey came before Prodigy, correct? Prodigy is relatively new, right?
Prodigy. I think we launched, it went on sale in like December 2017. So it's actually been out for quite a while. And we've been really, really happy about like, the response to it and how well, like how many people have been adopting it. Spacey's been there before. Matt, he left academia when he realized that like, wow, you know, the technology is becoming a lot more mature. Companies wanted to use his research code and asked him about licensing terms. And he was like, well, you know, if I actually focus on this and write a library that's really focused on doing all of this in production and getting stuff done, that could be, you know, really useful to people. So, he developed Spacey. It was, you know, released open source, and I kind of started working on it pretty much around the time it was first released. Okay. So that's when we started working together.
And so, as I mentioned in the intro, Spacey is a very popular library. I hear it come up all the time in the context of NLP. But for those that aren't familiar with it, can you maybe share a little bit about what makes it unique and the philosophy behind it relative to the many other libraries kind of in the NLP landscape?
Yeah, sure. So Spacey is a library for natural language processing in Python. So basically, if you have lots of text and pretty much any company, any kind of use case, you always end up with lots of text. And at some point, you want to find out more about that text. That also goes beyond like what you can personally read and also goes beyond a bit of like keyword search. So, you know, we want to find out like what companies are mentioned, what people, who says what and to whom, and how are the people, how are all the things and concepts and ideas related. And so Spacey is a library that can help you do that using rule-based methods, but also with using machine learning models. And by training, and you know, that also helps you train your own machine learning models to do these things. And the focus is really specifically on industry and production use cases. So I would say that's also where Spacey is a bit different from a lot of other libraries that focus a lot more on research. And you know, research is clearly like also a very important field, but we say, okay, instead of giving you lots of different ways to do one thing so you can, you know, compare them and, you know, compare different model architectures, we give you one way to do things. And, you know, one API, it's, you know, we focus a lot on having a concise API and also having like one implementation that does one thing. And, you know, that, and also I think, I guess one another thing Space is kind of famous for is that it's very fast. So that's another very important kind of goal we set ourselves, that like whatever we build and whatever we ship to people has to run fast enough that you can process millions, billions of documents, you know, in a time that's feasible for a production use case.
I imagine the 900-pound gorilla in the space is NLTK. Is that kind of the de facto standard for, you know, folks doing NLP in Python, or is there something else that comes to mind for you?
So NLTK is definitely a very popular library, and it's also one a library that many people have started working with when they and you know learned NLP. It's very it was initially developed for teaching and research. So it still has, you know, very wide adoption, but it's also very much research focused, like a lot of other, you know, libraries. We now have, you know, also there are lots of implementations that use PyTorch or TensorFlow to do NLP, but still there's very, you know, a lot of focus is on, you know, really building the model architectures. And we kind of start like kind of on the other side where we say, okay, we give you APIs, and basically the whole like, you know, container objects and the whole like infrastructure plus optimized statistical models to solve your NLP problems.
And you mentioned the that part of it is that it offers kind of facility for rule-based processing in addition to models. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? You know, obviously a lot of the excitement is around machine learning and models, but I just did a an interview yesterday, it hasn't been published yet, but we were talking about how, you know, in the real world, you know, in these production use cases, especially at scale, sometimes, you know, it just makes sense to do things with rules.
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely agree with that. Like, that's also something we see a lot. So, you know, what Spacey offers is kind of imagine regular expressions, but with like, you know, a lot of additional features that you can take advantage of, because, you know, we can now predict a lot of things about a sentence that holds a lot of deeper information. For example, you can find things in, but only if they attach to a verb, or you can, you know, use a lot of those like linguistic attributes to build a very, very complex or also a very simple, straightforward set of rules that lets you extract content or information that you're looking for. And especially actually if combined with statistical models, rule-based systems can be incredibly powerful. And it's also something we see a lot in a lot of industry use cases that actually, yeah, it's kind of, you know, the fun part is training all your hip neural network models and fiddling with the hyperparameters. But actually in production, what often really makes a difference is a really good set of rules that's been tested, validated, and built up over a long period of time and is really, really specific to the use case. And then that enhanced with some machine learning can actually often be much more effective than like an end-to-end approach.
Are there any use cases that come to mind as, you know, particularly exciting or even surprising? Wow, I never would have imagined someone would have done this with this code that we wrote.
I mean, in general, like, I'm one thing I'm always very, you know, excited about, or like what that was very eye opening, was that, like, it's really there are no like boundaries in like the industries that use NLP. Like, you know, often people think, oh, well, of course, the large like tech companies or anyone who's doing something with like all tech modern stuff will be using NLP. But it's like a lot of from aerospace to like, I don't know, energy companies. Everyone has text and everyone uses NLP. So often also when, you know, we have like new companies who start using Prodigy, our annotation tool, we're like, oh, wow, you use Spacey in production and you do NLP. Yeah, I guess it makes sense, but it's still, it's basically like, you know, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, I mean, use cases, I do have to say that the things that work best are probably not the most like, oh my God, exciting use cases. Like, you know, people love to talk about the really like, you know, cutting edge, like, I don't know, things you could have never guessed. But actually the stuff that works well is just like really good old like information extraction. You have some problem, you want to, for example, pre-fill a database with information from natural language text. And that's the stuff that actually works really, really well. And luckily, it's also kind of the stuff that like offers the biggest, return and monetary value to like companies doing that. Mm-hmm.
When you say the stuff, that's the stuff that works really, really well. Elaborate on that. Does that mean that it's the stuff that the library does best, or the stuff that folks have the most success in actually implementing, or something else?
I would say actually we're NLP in general, where the technology or doing machine learning with text actually has proven to work. Like, there are other fields, like, you know, we are seeing a lot of like you know, really cool like achievements in even conversational stuff, but like it's just that, and you know, that just doesn't yet work as well as, you know, people would maybe, you know, people on the outside would maybe imagine it to work. Like, you still don't have like a magical computer that can answer any question. The more information extraction stuff, which is also something we kind of focus on a bit because it works so well, is really what's, you know, that works. We can, you know, we can predict the right things, we can augment you know, the predictions with rules, and that's actually, yeah, it's just more successful than other more speculative areas.
Is Explosion you and Matt, or is it a bigger company than that today?
So it started out with only us, and it was only us for quite a while. We're now working with a few other people on different types of projects. So, you know, we currently have one person working full time together with us on cool new features for Spacey, which is really exciting. And then we have a few developers working on kind of an extension product to Prodigy, which we're currently finishing. But we're still a very small company and a very small team, and we also plan on staying a very small team. So that's definitely an important part of kind of our strategy.
And so when you think about Spacey as an open source project, is the contribution and the code from that primarily contributions made by the Explosion team? Or do you have, there's clearly a broad community there, but is it a broad user community or a contributing community or a little bit of both? How has that aspect of the project been?
So I would say, compared to other more community open source projects, we still have a fairly small number of like core contributors. That's true. So a lot of the sort of direction is driven by us, but it's also something that works well because you know, users use Spacey because they want to have like, you know, a good implementation, and they're like, okay, you guys do the implementation and we'll use it and we'll report bugs, and that's okay, that's fine, that's something we accept. Where we see a lot of contributions, especially like recently, is all the language specific stuff. So Spacey ships with a bunch of rules and a bunch of kind of base, basically the kind of the basic setup for all kinds of languages that we support. And that's really where people who are kind of new in the field can very easily help out. Like, you know, you could, if you speak or if you know some language, you could maybe add some rules to improve the way Spacey can tell what a word is and what's not a word and what's punctuation, for example, or, you know, add some other rules for lemmatization, or I don't know, just add some more tests. So that's where we see most of the community contributions. And that's also where the community contributions are most valuable.
Given the focus on rules and some of the fundamental NLP techniques, do you also track closely the more cutting edge stuff like
How does Spacey relate to, you know, these new models like BERT and GPT-2? Do you try to implement those and ship those with Spacey, or are they kind of separate?
Our mission has always been, we take what's proven to work in research and bring it into production so people can use it reliably. So that's always been our focus. Okay. So of course, we track what's going on. And then the next challenge is, okay, we have to see how are we implementing this in a way that it makes sense for people. Because, you know, often what's a bit unintuitive to people is that, well, you can't just pip install BERT and then it will just like run magically in your production application. But it's like, you know, it's a bit of, sometimes people have like this idea is like, oh, what can be so hard about like just giving us all of these models? But so what we do is we see, okay, how can we make this work? Also, how can we make this work with the performance targets we have? Like, if you have a system, you know, like BERT, where we basically predict the next word given, you know, the context and the previous words, those models are very, very large, and they're also not necessarily very fast. And at Spacey, we have like, performance target of like 10,000 tokens per second. That's pretty fast. So like, for example, to be able to implement this sort of idea, we came up with kind of our own way of doing this. So what we're doing in Spacey is we're actually predicting the vector of the next word, which makes our models much, much smaller and makes it much, much faster. But actually, yeah, with the latest version of Spacey, we were able to ship a pre-training feature lets people use those very new transfer learning techniques in NLP that have made the headlines recently. That's a very cool thing.
Yeah, can you elaborate a little bit more on that distinction, the distinction of predicting the vector of the next word as opposed to the next word, and how that gives you the performance increases?
Well, basically, I mean, if you're predicting the vector, you're only predicting kind of an approximation, and we can also take advantage of pre-trained word vectors that we already have. So like, you know, something like Word2Vec, we also ship like a pre-trained package, and you can actually, so instead of always keeping track of, you know, all of the individual words and having representations of all of these words, we actually only have like kind of the rough meaning representation, the word vector. So, we can predict that. We can take advantage of pre-trained word vectors we already have. And it basically makes the overall artifact much smaller. And we can rely on that at runtime. So it basically makes it faster and smaller. And there's some other tricks that we have in Spacey in a way we, store those vectors and, cache the data that also, you know, contribute a bit to the performance. We tried this out. We had this idea for a while, but we're like, we weren't sure if it would work. We ran some tests. It looked good. And actually what was really great was that like while we were trying this out, someone actually published a paper showing that it worked with exactly kind of the same idea. And we were like, yay. They did like, of course they did like much better experiments than we would have done. And they really did this well. So we were like, okay, that gave us a lot of confidence. And yeah, so we just shipped that with Spacey 2.1. And there are a lot of other things we're also like, you know, working on. And Spacey does have like its own neural network model implementations. We actually have kind of our own little library for that. So it is, you know, we're obviously very keen to keep up with what works, but it's also not like, you know, if you want to try out the latest like model architecture by, you know, in some paper that was recently published and compare that and hack around with it, Spacey is maybe not the best choice for that, because, you know, we give you the implementation once it's ready and once it's usable.
And so is Spacey, is it pure Python or is it written in C
Cython,
underneath,
yes,
or Cython?
Cython. So yeah. So it's Python with C extensions. Yeah.
Okay. And the NLP stuff that you're doing, are you writing that in Cython? Or are you writing that, like, do you ever like popping down into C to get speed, or is it all done in Python?
It depends. Like some aspects of the library were actually, you know, that really matters, is written in Cython. Other parts we can write in pure Python. I mean, it's kind of that's the nice thing about Cython, is that you can actually write Python, but can take advantage of the C whenever you need that. And it still all looks like Python, which, you know, makes it a bit more approachable. It still means that, okay, maybe for some contributors, it's a bit of a barrier because it's just like, I don't know, you have to know some arbitrary stuff. It needs to be compiled. So it's maybe not as approachable as a pure Python project. I'm not sure it's 50-50. It's like probably a bit less. Like mostly the models, of course, the model implementations are obviously in Cython. than some other, all the stuff that all the objects, container objects, all that like kind of infrastructure that needs to be really fast. And then some Python around it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not all that familiar with Cython. I assume that it was Python with an underlying C implementation, but it sounds like you're a bit more exposed to the C part with Cython if you're doing compiling and stuff like that.
You in the end you compile it, but it's more like what I meant was like, okay, the syntax, like I don't know, if you look at Spacey source and you look at the code and what it looks like, it's you'll be able to read it because it looks it's Python.
Okay.
Like the syntax is very, will look very familiar. They're just like some little things that look a bit different.
Okay. And is Spacey as well a commercial product for Explosion, or is Prodigy the first commercial product?
Prodigy is our first commercial product. And it was very important to us to kind of have a clear distinction between like the open source library and how we make money. At least in terms of, what you can use. Like Spacey is a free library and the code we believe is always, that's always going to be free and open source. And instead, we think that actually it's much nicer to monetize all the space around it. Like, for example, we can say, hey, if you're a power user of Spacey and you really like our open source software, we have something else that, you might be interested in, which our first product our first example of this is Prodigy. So, we actually think it's like, there's a lot of talk around like, how do you monetize open source? And we think that having a very clear separation between, okay, here's our free library, here's our free product, and here's our paid product, is actually very useful and very good.
Mm-hmm. Do you also provide commercial support for Spacey?
No. So actually that's another thing. Like, of course this is also a very common like business model, and it is what a lot of people do. And in some cases it works. It actually works quite well because you can have especially in like infrastructure, cloud stuff. There's a big space for like that sort of stuff. But for us, we always felt like you end up if you're the vendor and you're also like the author of the product, you often end up in this really weird situation where you want to provide like as much free support as possible. Like you want to have really great documentation. You want to have all of that stuff because you want people using the library. But at the same time, you want people to pay you to help them with it. And if your software is like quite easy to use, you're making less money because people don't actually need you. If you make your doc shit cool, people will actually come and want to pay you for providing the docs, but then you're soon running out of customers because your product is so shit that nobody's going to use it. So right. that is a real dilemma. And it's like, to be fair, okay, in machine learning, there's a lot more actually support wouldn't necessarily be support in terms of, hey, how do I install this? Or how do I write this kind of logic? It's more like, how should I structure my NLP project? So how should I do that kind of stuff? But we actually think there's, you can, people say, oh, you can run lots of companies, but like in reality, you could run one company. Like you could really only run one company. And we were like, okay, the company we want to run where we have the best like edge and where we actually, also what we enjoy doing is building developer tools. It's not running a support company.
Can you talk a little bit about Prodigy and the focus there? Is it specifically focused on annotation for NLP types of problems or textual data sets, or is it broader than that?
I mean, in general, I would say more generally machine learning, but of course, the NLP support is probably the best because that's also, compared to the other areas of machine learning, also just because that's what we also know best. So I would say, maybe we have a bit more in there that's useful for NLP compared to computer vision.
Okay.
But the idea is basically, yes, it's an annotation tool for data science and machine learning. And it was basically inspired by us, like, very early on in the company for a few months, we took on some consulting projects and we saw that like one topic that always came up in everyone we talked to was labeling data. And also this whole like, okay, a lot of companies would either do it in like Excel spreadsheets or they just send it off to Mechanical Turk, then they'd get it back, train a model, wouldn't work. People were not very happy with their workflows around that. And we kind of saw a gap for like actually a tool that lets the data scientists get a bit closer to that sort of data collection process. Because if you outsource that completely. You're actually outsourcing a lot of the decisions about how your model is going to perform and what your model is going to do, because ultimately the labels are what you're going to predict and how your application is going to work.
Right.
And that's actually quite ineffective. So instead, what we're suggesting is a much, much closer workflow where the data scientist can, or the developers, engineer, whatever, can be involved in the initial labeling process. Basically, you can write little Python scripts that queue up the work. You can try out concepts much more quickly because we've built a very, very efficient, very fast interface that lets you move through the examples quickly. We have some approaches where you can try and put a model in the loop. And instead of doing everything from scratch, correcting the model's predictions. And the idea is, sure, we're not saying, oh, the data scientist just has to do it all themselves by hand, but you can actually, label a few thousand examples in an hour and then train your model, see if your idea worked. Most likely it won't work because nothing ever works on the first try, or most things will never work at all in data science. And that's just the reality of things. And are you saying, okay, you need to, if you can find what fails quicker and find what succeeds quicker as well, you're actually going to be more successful. And that was what motivated Prodigy and the way we set it up as a developer tool and not just as some like platform.
It's interesting that you describe it like that, as a developer tool and not just some platform, because when I think about the things that you've done, in my head, it sounds a lot more like a platform than a developer tool.
Yeah.
In the sense of, for example, you talk about how you can put the model in a loop. And I've heard Prodigy come up in a number of conversations in the context of active learning. And that starts to sound to me a lot more like platform than, tool like an Excel or some other kind of desktop thing that's just allowing me to like crank through a bunch of text or images and put labels next to stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the big differences as well is that, we built developer tools and all our tools are very data privacy focused. Mm-hmm. Spacy, you install that, you run it on your machine. It's not just like some software as a service API. And also it's just like an open source.
Got it.
And the same with Prodigy is, it's not like, an free open source product, but it's a product and it's a library as well. And you can download it, you install it on your own machine. It works completely offline and it just like runs on your hardware. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, it feels a bit more, like I often compare to Adobe Creative Suite before they went all cloud. You could buy Photoshop and then you would download Photoshop and then you would have it.
Right.
And
right.
Then they wouldn't take it away from you and you could use it. And then if in 2 years you pick up your design project, it's all still there because you still have Photoshop. And mm-hmm. that's also how we see these things. And that's also how Prodigy functions, at least the developer tool version.
Got it.
And yeah. And also because, another thing is actually, we call this let them write code. It's basically developers can program and they like to program. And often instead of coming up with like very complex arbitrary configuration languages and APIs to do stuff, often the best way to configure a program or configure something that you want to do is to write a few lines of code. So Prodigy can be configured fully in a Python script. So if you want to load some data from some arbitrary database that you have and then like filter it that way, we're like, cool, can you write that in Python? Yes, cool, you can use it. So that's another thing where I think the developer tool angle comes in, and also it's something that people actually really, really like about this. Developers generally like tools that don't lock them in and tools that they can interact with via a programming language, mm-hmm. naturally.
Can you elaborate on that last example or maybe provide an example of just the user experience of Prodigy and, for a given use case, and what's the code that you might need to write and how you might integrate a model in a loop? Like, how do all the pieces fit together?
Yeah, so we have a few like built-in workflows. So it's like, you can use it, and maybe you don't often have to really write your own code from scratch. But the idea is, at the center of it are recipes, we call it, which are Python functions. So they're Python functions that we turn into a command. So one of them could be, okay, let's say you have some raw text you want to load in, and you have a pre-trained model that you've downloaded from Spacey that can predict person names. But because your text is like obviously quite specific, and maybe you're working in like finance or something, and it has like person names or organization names that are quite different from like some generic pre-trained model. So you're like, okay, you want to see, can I improve that pre-trained model on my data so it performs a bit better? So you can run one of these command line scripts, you pass in the path to your data file, you pass in the pre-trained model you want to use, you pass in some labels, and then you start that up, and then you get the annotation interface, and it will highlight a prediction from the model, and you can say, yep, that's correct, or you can say, no, that's wrong. And what under the hood, what we do there is we load up the model, and we'll get all possible predictions for each example. And then all of these possible predictions will come with a score. And then by default, we'll focus on the scores that are closest to 0.5. So the ones where the model is most uncertain, mm-hmm. Basically. So that's also what's referred to as uncertainty sampling in active learning. So the idea here is if we focus on the ones where like the model isn't sure, that's also where your decision will have the highest impact. If you're only labeling things where the model is like super confident that it's correct, the labels and the annotations you provide have like, also the gradient from that is just less significant than if you focus on the ones where the model isn't sure at all whether it's like A or B or nothing. So that's one possible workflow that you could use. And then, that's actually super fast. You're just clicking yes or no. You're focusing on one thing at a time. You can easily collect a few hundred annotations in like 10, 15 minutes. And then you can run a little training command, update your model, and just see what the results look like. They're obviously not going to be like the most, they're not going to be the definitive results that you can report at the end, but they give you some idea whether what you had in mind there is good or not. Mm-hmm. If you see that like the model's not learning anything, then you have at least some idea that like maybe my idea wasn't that great, or maybe it's just more difficult than I thought it would be. Or if you're like, oh, accuracy is going up, that looks promising, I should spend a bit more time on that.
One of the things I hear from folks is about the need to kind of drive repeatability into the process of collecting and labeling data and producing models. Does the fact that Prodigy is a standalone tool get in the way of doing that? Or are there ways to kind of fit it into a broader pipeline or workload that allow you to establish some degree of repeatability or consistency?
Yeah, no, I think in the end, if you, for example, if you're writing your own functions, you can actually have, the script that you can, you can commit your script to your GitHub repository and you have that and everyone can always, reproduce the logic you use to, for example, select your examples. Another thing we think is quite important is that a lot of problems people have down the line often come down to problems with, the label scheme and how the task is defined in the first place. Often you're like, oh, I want a label like, I want my model to predict this, or my system needs to do X. And often people approach this from the very end-to-end viewpoint. And often that's not necessarily the one that like works best. And any label scheme, anything, basically defining what you want your model to predict often needs lots of iterations. And once you get that right, you're often... that's where it really starts working.
Is there a specific example of that that comes to mind?
One thing we see a lot is that like people often start, a machine or a data science project often starts with like so a defined set of categories that you want to, categorize your texts into. So you might have like something like different types of clothing, for example, and you want to extract that from like your customer emails. And so you have like, the data scientist starts off with like a very broad catalog of like every type of clothing we offer and every type of clothing that like the system needs to categorize. And then often, one approach could be, okay, well, we need to take a few million examples or, emails and have someone label them and select out of our hundreds of clothing types what clothing types are mentioned. And I mean, this sounds like a very straightforward approach, but often probably, at some point down the line, you'll notice that like your machine learning model is actually really, really bad at distinguishing adult shoes from kids' shoes. for example, mm-hmm. in, you know, the like brand names or, you know, summer cold and winter colds. You know, that's something maybe you can, you know, but like that's probably something that's very quite, that could be quite difficult to predict just on the basis of like the raw text and the surrounding words. So, you know, one approach that you could then, after, you know, you try this out, you realize, ah, my model's not learning anything. And then, you know, you're like, okay, how could I improve that? One approach could be you start with a much more broader definition. You start, okay, first I'll let my model label whether something is clothing. You know, you can start, okay, start collecting some data for that and then train it. Okay, actually looks pretty good. Next step, okay, maybe we can add another model component that then, given a clothing item or clothing brand, can then, you know, assign it to one of our, you know, entries in a knowledge base or to a more fine-grained category and so on. Like, that's just one example that just came to mind. And in the end, you know, that stuff really matters. That's like, you know, you end up at the same results, but the process how you got there is very, very different. And it can easily take a few iterations to get to the point where you have a good idea for what can my model learn. And what's actually feasible and what machine learning tasks do I have to break this larger, very abstract business goal into?
I'm curious, what are some of the things, you know, the NLP space, as with all of machine learning, is, you know, changes rapidly, lots of exciting stuff happening. We talked about some of that in terms of these new language models. I'm curious, what are you most excited about in this space?
So definitely, I mean, the transfer learning stuff was definitely like a big breakthrough, because we've always, for quite a long time, we were like, okay, this should be possible. And it was kind of, you know, I think for many people in the space, it was kind of clear, like, okay, at some point, hopefully someone's going to show, here's how we should do it. And especially the fact that, like, you know, we can potentially pre-train embeddings that would allow us to get much, much better results much more quickly with significantly fewer examples. And that doesn't mean that, like, you know, labeling examples becomes less relevant. Actually, you know, I think it means it, you know, you can try out more and it becomes a lot more relevant because, you know, cool, if you only need like 200 labeled examples to really get a very definitive idea of whether what you're trying to train works or not, that means you can, like, you know, you can train much, much more quickly and you can train so many more models so much faster. You can try out so many more ideas. And I think that's like, that's super exciting. And yeah, it's really cool to see this already working quite well.
Are there other things happening that you're particularly paying attention to?
Let me think. So I mean, one thing we like, I could talk about one thing we're working on at the moment is entity linking, which I also think is really cool. So basically, you know, the concept of you have like a person name and you want to link that back to a knowledge base. And it sounds, you know, the kind of concept sounds quite simple, but it's actually, you know, there's a lot you have to consider. And you actually, you know, you have a mention of Apple, or like, actually, I'm trying to think of a better, like, more, you know, ambiguous example. But like, there are a lot of these like names, and there are different options. It depends on the context. And, you know, you want to assign those back to large knowledge bases. Yeah, that's a feature that's, yeah, maybe not as like, ooh, shiny, new cutting edge stuff, but it's actually another one that like people really need, people really want, and that's going to make a huge difference for people using NLP for a variety of like business use cases and industry use cases.
A feature like that is, are you typically, well, not typically, but in this case, are you attacking that using traditional rules-based or heuristic types of approaches or machine learning or neural nets? Like, where in the spectrum, you know, which of the tools do you use to, you know, build out a feature like that?
I mean, well, it depends on the feature. Like, you know, in this case, it is a combination of machine learning and kind of ties in with the rule-based approaches. It also ties in with like the neural network models we already have, which are the models that actually predict entities in the first place. So, I mean, it always depends on the use case. But like, what, you know, for us, what matters is, well, what works best and what's fast, what's efficient, and what actually works best, what generalizes best, and what's customizable. Because, you know, ultimately, it's nice if we can provide people with a pre-trained model that happens to work quite nicely on, you know, some academic benchmark task. But what people really want to do is they want to plug in their own data, and they want to plug in their own stuff, and they want to plug in their own like ideas and goals. And so that's also kind of how we decide how to approach a thing. Like, you know, we're not in a position where we have to, you know, come up with like what's a good paper to write. Like I'm not even, you know, dismissing that. That's a very like genuine like valid motivation that people in research would have. But what's, you know, a good paper is not necessarily what like, you know, people actually will find like the most useful as in a practical application.
If you were starting over with Spacey, are there things that you do very differently?
Oh, that's a really good question, actually. I'm not sure if I've thought about this much. I mean, there obviously some API decisions that like I would have done differently, or we would have probably done differently. Just like, I mean, it's mostly just like small stuff where, you know, you design something one way and then you realize, that's kind of confusing, or like kind of taking on this life of its own and doesn't send the right message. We should have done this differently. Otherwise, you know, it always depends on, okay, what you have like available and, you know, what was like possible at the time. But actually, I think I'm quite happy with like, you know, the progression. Like, sure, sometimes I wish like, you know, we would have had like more time that we could have like, you know, spend on the project to work on that, because, okay, you know, it was very important for us to stay independent and be independent. So, you know, while we were like initially like bootstrapping the company, we had a bit less time. But yeah, like in hindsight, like I'm very happy with how things turned out. And
On that theme of independence, and you previously mentioned that you intend for Explosion to remain a small company. Talk a little bit about that and your motivation or philosophy there, and any thoughts for folks that are also interested in kind of contributing in the space, but aren't necessarily excited about doing it in the context of a large company?
Yeah. I mean, for us, like you already see this in all kinds of other software projects that like a lot of software is actually written by a very, very small number of people. Like even if you look at very large like libraries, it's, it's not like, you know, thousands of people kind of worked on the same piece of code. It's like often development teams are very small, and like for a reason, because, you know, it's like, you know, writing a novel with like 200 people, that's like, you know, that's a fun art project, but that's not necessarily like, you know, that's not going to be the best novel you've ever read. So, software teams are often by definition are quite small. And another thing is that actually by being quite small, you can really take a lot of advantage of, very diverse skill sets that large companies can't necessarily. So, you know, large companies often hire in a very particular way because you have to hire in a way that makes your team more interchangeable. Like you need a lot of people that are quite similar, because, you know, if you're scaling this up, that's kind of the most efficient. But if you're a small team, you can actually, hire a lot of people with very specific skills that work for, a specific task. Then you can have people with kind of overlapping skills, people with a broad foundation in one technology, but who also have done like other things. Like it's often referred to as T-shaped skills, because, you know, kind of like a T-shirt. So you have like, I've always found this a super weird metaphor, because like it's a T-shirt, but like, you know, you have a broad kind of a broad foundation and then like these like arms. But I've started calling it more like, you know, I think of it more as like tree-shaped skills. You know, you have like the stem, and then you have all these like branches, and you can have like, you can have small branches, you can have big branches, you can have like different branches in different directions. Branches can overlap with like some other tree. You can grow new branches, which actually, this is another reason, like, yeah, I hate a T-shirt metaphor, because it's like a T-shirt can only like get worse once it's like there. Whereas a tree, you know, a tree can grow. There's like life in it. But basically that's the idea we've had like for our team. We can actually, you know, really have like, complementary skills in a team and, you know, really take advantage of that. And it's not like, you know, it's not like large companies are not doing that because they're like stupid and don't see this. They like can't, because of, you know, they operate slightly differently. So, we are small, but we can still do things. And it's still, I, yeah, there's one anecdote that like I sometimes tell in this kind of context, which is we were asked whether our company would pass the bus test, because for someone who wanted to buy our software, this was like this was important. And for anyone who doesn't know what the bus test is, it's like it's a varying number of people, but it's basically if 4 people were run over by a bus tomorrow, would your company still exist? And at that time, we were like 2 people. We were like, no, we'd be -2. But it's also, it's a very weird concept. The person ended up buying Prodigy anyways, but like it's an interesting framework that some people use and that I don't think makes much sense, because essentially you're always asking like, well, how interchangeable are like your people? And, you know, who could you afford to like spare in a bus accident? Mm-hmm. And yeah. So I've always found this kind of weird, and like we proudly do not pass the bus test. We kind of pass it now, but like we'd be in a pretty bad state.
An interesting anecdote along those lines. I was just this morning reading an article about long story, this lawsuit that Hertz is apparently suing Accenture for botching this digital transformation project. It was going around on Twitter. And if you read there's a $35 million project to build some website that kind of integrates into their reservation systems, kind of, update their website. And you read the lawsuit and all of the things that, you know, could have been done so much better on both sides. But, you know, in particular, there's this one point where they talked about how kind of Accenture had full ownership of this project. And there were 2 people that knew the project, and they pulled them off and put them onto something else. And that was one of the reasons why this thing got delayed by 2 years and never got finished.
Yeah. And then, I mean, they built a website that wasn't responsive, and like everything was, we were so insecure. It was like unusable. Where I'm right. like, wow, right. that's a skill. Like, you know, it's, you can build so much stuff nowadays that like works okay, even if it's kind of crap. So
there's so many lessons there, but the thing that connected to what you were speaking was, you know, even Accenture, you know, in this case, couldn't pass the bus test.
Yeah.
And they pulled these 2 people off, and, you know, that was a significant contributor to the failure of this project. So
I think it's a very bizarre metric. Yeah. And yeah, so that was one of the things we saw this early on. We're like, well, we could, you know, we were already doing great stuff when we were 2 people. Okay, if we have a few more people and they're the right people, we can do even more stuff. And that's like, fine. We also get to, you know, focus a lot more on the core work, because we have fewer distractions that, you know, you'd normally have if you, you know, not like if you, for example, if you're running at a loss, which is also something we said, okay, we don't want to be doing. We actually, because I think, you know, for there are many legitimate reasons why your company would want to start and run at a loss or at a significant loss very early on, and why you would have to, you know, where you need capital and why you would have to make the decision to sell equity in order to function. But we were always in a, you know, very good position that we didn't have to do that. And so also we thought, okay, for what we're doing, there's absolutely no logical reason we would have to be running at a loss. We can actually run at a profit, because we can have a product and people can buy our product, and then, you know, we can sell more products and we can make more products and do more things. And then people can, you know, give us money, and then we can spend less money than that. And then we'll have some money left over. It's kind of, it's a very crazy concept, but like, you know, it works.
Virtuous cycle.
Yeah. So that was another thing that really, you know, helped us, you know, stay focused and do our things, and also being able to really, you know, you know, it's one thing you can validate your ideas, like, by, I don't know, talking to people, doing like surveys and doing like all kinds of things. But like in the end, making a profit and making money is like a very, very good way to validate what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And it's also a very honest way of validate. Like, you know, money doesn't really lie. Like if nobody wants to buy your product, then well, nobody wants to buy your product. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that's a pretty clear sign. And on the other hand, okay, if you see, cool, what I'm doing works, people like it so far, people are interested in buying that, that's a very good, you know, that's a very good way to validate your ideas. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, we see this, that's a much better KPI than a lot of other things.
Well, Ines, thank you so much for taking the time to share what you're up to. It's great getting to know you and Explosion and Spacey and Prodigy a little bit better. I really enjoyed our chat.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. If you like what you've heard here, please do us a huge favor and tell your friends about the show. And if you haven't already hit that subscribe button yourself,
Make sure you do so you don't miss any of the great episodes we've got in store for you. As always, thanks so much for listening and catch you next time.